And joining us on the book club today is award-winning author, New York Times bestselling author, Blaine Harden. Blaine is the author of the book, Murder at the Mission, A Frontier Killing, Its Legacy of Lies, and the Taking of the American West. Blaine, thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be here.
Let me tell people a little bit about more about yourself here. First of all, you worked for 28 years at the Washington Post as a correspondent in Africa, Eastern Europe and Asia, as well as in New York and Seattle. You also worked for 4 years as a local and national correspondent for the New York Times and a writer for Time Magazine. You worked also as a reporter for Frontline, the Economic Foreign Policy, National Geographic, and The Guardian. And you have been featured also in PBS American Experience, the program titled Grand Coulee Dam, about the Grand Coulee Dam. So thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Now, first of all, let's talk a little bit about, because these books that you've written have all been, in a way, kind of, you know, historical, documentary-type books. It doesn't read like that. Murder at the Mission does not read like that. But tell us, have you always been interested in kind of historical things?
Well, you know, no, I don't think so. I think I grew up like a kid, many kids in America. I wasn't interested in anything but in popular culture. And I grew up in Eastern Washington, which is, people don't know, Washington State is sort of cut in half by the Cascade Mountains. The west side, where Seattle is wet, and there are lots of trees, but the east side is dry. It's kind of like Texas, as a matter of fact. It's semi-arid, and the federal government is very important there in irrigation schemes that make life possible, and none of that was of any interest to me at all, including the various tribal people who lived around my hometown. I left, I went to college, but it was only after I became a reporter and became a foreign correspondent that I started to get interested in history and the importance of history as it percolates down into the lives of the people on the ground. And it was with that new understanding and new skills as a reporter, a researcher, that I came back to my home country. This is my second book about the Pacific Northwest. I wrote one about the damming of the Columbia River about 20 years ago. And so this new book is a kind of continuation of that curiosity to examine some of the underpinnings of the life that I lived when I was a kid.
A lot of times, sometimes, you know, people will say, well, this person is a journalist, they're a writer, they work in television news or radio news or print, so it shouldn't be that hard for them to write books. But that's not the case.
No, writing a book is a lot different than regular journalism. For one thing, it takes years. I've been working on this book on and off for about 4 years, but mostly on. There's the slow process of getting the information that you need and verifying it, which takes years. And then there's the process of trying to tell it in a way that will engage people who know nothing about the region or the subject and who may not care about it. And to do that, you have to give them characters, you have to give them a plot, and you have to give them crisp writing that makes it entertaining and sometimes even funny. One tries to use all of those techniques to tell an important and true story.
So I know that you mentioned that you really didn't get interested until you started working as a correspondent in history and all that. But you open up the book with you being in a school play about this particular incident, the Whitman incident, and at that time, obviously, as you mentioned, you really weren't that, you know, serious, interested about it. At what point did you decide, you know what, I'm going to look more into this?
Well, that's just been in the past 4 years. What I learned when I was a kid in elementary school in a town called Moses Lake in eastern Washington was that Marcus Whitman, who was a missionary, and his wife Narcissa, were good Christian Americans who had come to the Northwest to convert the Indians to Christianity and improve their lives. And after a while, the ungrateful Indians killed them. And that's basically what I learned. And I also learned that Whitman was a hero who'd helped save the Pacific Northwest from being taken away by a British plot to make that part of Canada. And, you know, I learned that story, and it sank in. A lot of baby boomers of my generation and geographic location learned the same story from the public schools. But I didn't start to really dig into it until about 4 years ago.
We're visiting with Blaine Harden, award-winning author and journalist. His latest book is Murder at the Mission, A Frontier Killing, Its Legacy of Lies and the Taking of the American West. Before the interview started, you and I were discussing a little bit about the L.A. Times article that came out about your book, a wonderful article. And they start off with an African proverb that it's incredible. Until the lions have their own historians, the hunt will always glorify the hunter.
That's right. And the story of Marcus Whitman is just a wonderful example of that. So Whitman, there's two elements to his story. One is true and important in the history of the United States. One is false and also important in the history of the United States. The true story is that Whitman and his wife were missionaries who were quite unsuccessful. After 11 years of trying to convert the Cayuse tribe to Christianity, they'd managed to convert only two individuals. And at the same time, they had really worn out their welcome. They had become sort of agents for white settlement in Cayuse country, and also they had their presence coincided with the arrival of some very serious infectious diseases from European people. And in 1847, a measles epidemic slammed the Cayuse tribe, killed as many as half of their children. And they had a long tradition of killing medicine men who failed to practice good medicine. And Marcus Whitman, besides being a missionary, was a medical doctor. In fact, he used bleeding as a method of treating measles. Didn't work out very well. Lots of Indians died. And so a few Cayuse warriors in November of 1847 killed Marcus Whitman and his wife and 11 other white people. That killing, which became infamous as the Whitman Massacre, was an actual historical event. And news of it, when it reached Congress about 6 to 8 months later, precipitated a decision by the U.S. government to make the Oregon country, which was not a part of the United States at the time. It was jointly held with the British under a treaty. They declared that it was part of the United States. It became the Oregon Territory, and within a couple decades, it became the states of Oregon, Washington, and then later Idaho. So that's the importance of Whitman historically. The lie about Whitman was cooked up about 20 years after his death, and it was cooked up by a fellow missionary named Henry Spaulding, the Reverend Henry Spaulding, who over the course of decades invented a story about Whitman's greatness. And the story was this, that Whitman, before he was murdered, he had perceived a threat from the British and from Catholics and from Indians to steal away the Oregon country, the Pacific Northwest, from the United States and make it part of Britain. And courageously, according to Spaulding's phony story, Marcus Whitman got on his horse and decided he'd rush to Washington and tell the president that the British were coming and that something needed to be done to save Oregon. And the story goes that he went to the White House and he changed the minds of President Tyler and Secretary of State Webster, and the Oregon country was saved. And the story was ridiculous and false, but it was very seductive to the American ear. It confirmed the idea that missionaries are good, that manifest destiny is good, that Indians are bad, Catholics are bad. There was a large wave of immigration around that time in the middle of the 1800s, and lots of Catholics were coming into the country, which freaked out a lot of Protestants. In any case, the story became popular, and Spaulding got it printed by Congress as a pamphlet. That pamphlet became the primary source for history books, and most of the history books in America from 1880 till about 1905 printed the story of Marcus Whitman saving Oregon. And he was recognized by American intellectuals at the turn of the century as one of the most important explorers in the country's history.
We're visiting with award-winning author and journalist, New York Times bestselling author, Blaine Harden. We are talking about his latest book, Murder at the Mission, A Frontier Killing, Its Legacy of Lies and the Taking of the American West. The thing that jumped out at me, Blaine, when I read the African proverb that I mentioned earlier is, you know, when I was a kid, perhaps even when you were a kid, whenever we would read or watch a movie about the Old West, if the Indians won, it was always a massacre, and if the cavalry won, it was always a victory.
It's true. I mean, the language says it all. I mean, the victors describe what happened, and they take all the credit and none of the blame. And that's certainly the case in the Whitman story. The truth was that Marcus Whitman was a utter failure as a missionary. He and his wife were very ethnocentric, which was not unusual in those days, and they really did not pay attention to the Cayuse people among whom they lived as individuals. They didn't want them around. They thought they had fleas, and they basically had turned their back on them at the time of the killing. And this, that is not an unusual story for missionaries in the West.
Why is it that Reverend Spalding would do what he did? Because as we read in the book, initially he's interested in Narcissa. He proposes to her. She turns him down. She ends up marrying the Dr. Whitman later. And then after almost like playing hard to get, Spalding decides to go with him. But he was a thorn in their side for a long time.
He tormented them, in part out of pique, I believe, because he'd been rejected by Narcissa. He may have been jealous of Marcus because of Narcissa and because of other reasons. Spalding was an irritating man with a chip on his shoulder. But he was also quite brilliant, and after they were killed in 1847, he realized very quickly the symbolic resonance of their death in the American understanding of the settlement of the West. Whether he understood that at an intellectual level or more of a emotional level, he began to cook up this story that sold his former enemies as heroes. And he, in fact, turned them into legends. And in the process of doing that, he made himself respectable. He found a federal job working at the Nez Perce Reservation, where he'd long wanted to work. And he also sort of vindicated the missionary experience in Oregon, which had been riddled with backbiting and tattletaling among the missionaries who did not get along. But in Spalding's version of history, everything was magnificent.
Could it be said that Reverend Spalding and the way he sugarcoated everything, yet if you look deep inside, you find out that Reverend Spalding was not, quote, Christ-like, if you want to call it that. He mistreated some of the Cayuse tribe members. And then also when he went and was working among the Nez Perce, the same thing.
Well, Spalding would occasionally use the whip on Nez Perce people who he believed were not living up to his standards of Christian comportment. But at the same time, Spalding was a relatively successful missionary in that he converted. He got several hundred Nez Perce tribal people to follow Christian teachings. He was not an absolutist. He found that if Indians tried to live their life according to the teachings of Christ, he would say, "That's good enough. I'll baptize you." Marcus Whitman and some of the other missionaries who came west with him were much more prickly and more persnickety about who they would baptize. They required almost impossible conversion and familiarity with Calvinist Protestantism before they would baptize and convert anybody. So there was a paradox with Spalding, is he actually was quite a good missionary among the Nez Perce, but at the same time, he was a prickly, irritating fabulist who made up huge lies and managed to sell them to the American people.
We're visiting with award-winning author and journalist, New York Times bestselling author, Blaine Harden. The book is Murder at the Mission, A Frontier Killing, Its Legacy of Lies and the Taking of the American West. You mentioned in the book, and you mentioned it earlier also, Blaine, about manifest destiny. And would you mind sharing that with our listeners as to what that is and how that came about?
In the early 1800s, there was a huge religious revival in the United States. In the 1790s, a relatively small percentage of Americans went to church regularly. And then something came along, and it was referred to by historians as the Second Great Awakening. And as part of this awakening, Americans converted to Protestantism and became church-going and really believed in the idea of conversion of Indians in the American West and of foreigners all around the world. And they contributed their at church, Sunday services to the funding of missionaries. And the idea of Christianity triumphant was married to the idea of American settlement of the West. The Louisiana Purchase, the acquisition of Texas and California, the settlement of the Oregon Territory. There was this vast, vast territory to be settled. And what happened in the 1830s and 1840s is the idea of settling all this land and of doing it in God's name, they became part of the same idea, and that idea became known as Manifest Destiny. And the Whitmans went out. They were at the vanguard of the early white settlers to come to the Pacific Northwest to prepare the native people for the coming of white people in huge numbers. And what they wanted to do is they wanted to convert these people to Christianity and to familiarize them with white cultural practices so that they would not be exterminated. And in that sense, their motivation was good. And that's what brought them out there and started their work. Unfortunately, they were so ethnocentric and so ill-equipped to deal with the mindset of the people they were trying to convert that, by and large, they were complete failures.
We're visiting with New York Times bestselling author, award-winning author, and journalist Blaine Harden. The name of the book is Murder at the Mission, Frontier Killing, Its Legacy of Lies and Taking of the American West. The book flows very well. I mean, it's not like an academic book. It's not a documentary type book. But you guide us through everything that we know we've been talking about. And I was interested about, as you just mentioned, about the history. Towards the end of the book, you mentioned the lady Bobby Connor. And she is the director of the, I believe it's Community Development Department. And she had met with some of the tribes to kind of clarify what exactly happened.
Right. The Cayuse people, their ancestors did kill the Whitmans. But they killed the Whitmans for failing to do a good job as missionaries. Under their law and their traditions, because Whitman had brought measles and brought white people to them, that he was, and they told him repeatedly over the course of several years to take a hike to get away from Cayuse country, but he refused to leave. So they felt, and they still feel, that his killing was justified under their traditions and their laws. So that happened in 1847. And when Whitman died, he was just a missionary, not well known. He was not a national figure. He was not a hero who had saved Oregon. Unfortunately for the Cayuse people, Spalding made up this story, this phony story about Whitman, and it became so popular. And so willy-nilly, they turned into the people who killed a national hero. And they were doubly demonized then for having done this terrible thing. And the legacy of that accusation, it soured their lives for 150 years. They felt ashamed. They felt traumatized. They felt even isolated from other Indian tribes on the Columbia Plateau who blamed the Cayuse for causing so much trouble. In any case, time passed, by the end of the 20th century, the Cayuse had managed to sort of rehabilitate the reservation that they lived on, the Umatilla Reservation, and have used gaming money to create a really viable reservation that has businesses and good social services. But the process was long and extremely painful for them.
Tell us about last summer, and even as we're talking, there have been issues about history that was not true. Or how many times have we heard the phrase fake news, fake stories? And along with that, with our history, what we've learned, a lot of statues have been brought down. And there was a statue of Mr. Whitman.
Right. There still is a statue of Marcus Whitman's statue. He was chosen as the outstanding individual who'd come to Washington State, the outstanding Washingtonian, to be represented with a statue in the Hall of Statuary in the U.S. Capitol. This happened in 1953. Strangely, 50 years prior to that, the whole story of Whitman's heroism had been debunked by historians at Yale. But in any case, the Pacific Northwest continued to believe in Whitman and his heroism. So in 1953, his statue was dedicated in Washington, D.C. Just 2 weeks ago, the state of Washington decided that this was a mistake, that Whitman was not the outstanding representative of the state of Washington, and so he was replaced. The statue is still there, but sometime this summer, it will be transported back to Washington and replaced by a statue of Billy Frank Jr., a Nisqually tribal member from Western Washington who championed treaty rights and protected the environment in the Pacific Northwest and was arrested more than 50 times exercising his treaty-protected right to fish on rivers around the place where he grew up. And that's what's changed. So there has been a society-wide official acknowledgement that the hoax, it's long past times for this hoax to be repudiated and put somewhere in a dusty closet.
Tell us a little bit about, perhaps we have a few minutes left here, Bladen. How has your book been received as far as historical, changing books, the story being changed from martyrdom to whatever you want to call it, for Reverend Whitman and his wife, Narcissa?
Well, I think the place that cares most about this story is Whitman College, which is an excellent liberal arts college right now over near Walla Walla. That college would not have survived bankruptcy in the 1890s without promulgating the lie and selling it across the country. And so the school itself is sort of knee-deep in the false story about who Whitman was. As the 20th century unfolded, the school quietly backed away from that story. And since then, students and faculty have been very uncomfortable with the Whitman story. There's a statue of Whitman identical to the one that's in the U.S. Capitol that's about to be removed. In the 1990s, someone made a copy of the statue and gave it to the college, but the college really didn't want it. And so they took the statue, and the faculty was a faculty committee was created to decide where to put the statue on campus. And I talked to a professor who was on that committee, as they decided to put the statue on the very, very edge of campus near a railroad tracks. And as the faculty member told me, they hoped that a train would derail and take out the statue. So there's real ambivalence among the faculty and students about Marcus Whitman. And just last week, in fact, students were demonstrating on campus to have that statue removed.
What about Narcissa's legacy?
Well, interesting. There was a monument to Narcissa, which stood outside of Prentice Hall. Her maiden name was Prentice, and Prentice Hall has been a longstanding hall for students at Whitman College. In December, that monument was quietly removed. And about 4 years before that, an idealized portrait of Narcissa Whitman that had hung in Prentice Hall for years, someone spilled black paint all over it. So her reputation, too, has taken some hits. I think Narcissa Whitman was very much a tragic figure. She was a gifted writer. In fact, her writing about her experience of traveling to the West and living among the Cayuse, her writing was widely read, and it was very affecting. And it told a mostly true and emotional story about being a missionary woman in that time. But she should not have stayed after the Cayuse told her and her husband to leave. She should have gone back to New York and become a figure of, a writer, a figure of religious importance. She stayed too long, and she was ill-suited to the work.
Blaine, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us here today. We have been visiting with New York Times bestselling author, award-winning author, and journalist Blaine Harden. Blaine's latest book is called Murder at the Mission, A Frontier Killing, Its Legacy of Lies, and the Taking of the American West. If you want to find out more, you can go to BlaineHarden.com. There's also some various articles that have been out about the book. The LA Times had one recently. And yesterday, the New York Times also had a very nice story about the book. Blaine, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
The book club is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Sam Cassiano. You've been tuned to The Book Club. I'm Dewey Science.
Support for production of The Book Club on KTEP comes from the estate of Maxie Templeton.
Next time on the New York Philharmonic this week, Sergei Leifer-Kus is the soloist in the Symphony No. 13 by Dmitri Shostakovich. This is Alec Baldwin. Please join me for this program, which will open with Schubert's unfinished symphony. Music director emeritus Court Mazur will conduct the New York Philharmonic this week.
Tune in this Tuesday night at 8 p.m. on KTEP.
On the next Living on Earth, research debunks the myth of the tragedy of the commons as inevitable.
We do have a huge capacity to be destructive, to harm other species, but we also have huge capacity to be constructive, and that's what I hope we can take advantage of in the years to come.
I'm Jenny Doring, some heroes of conservation, next time on Living on Earth from PRX.
Sunday evening at 8 on KTEP.
More of the country's youngest talent on this edition of From the Top. Good afternoon. It's 1 o'clock. You're listening to 88.5 FM KTEP El Paso.